Okay, so a couple of disclaimers first. I didn't know I was giving this, no. I had no inkling that I was going to try to volunteer to give this talk until I heard a couple of talks last week, and I thought it might be a really nice opportunity to take advantage of the assembled, sort of the assembled us. And so this is, I apologize, a little rough, as in I'm making it up as I put the slides up. So what I want to talk about is the problem of the origin of eukaryotes. I'll give a little bit of background, and you guys should please make me explain. I have a bunch more slides sort of in reserve where we can look at different, explore different background things until we get sort of happily up to speed. But then talk about how some of the population genetic concepts that were all brought up last week might be potentially useful and bring an added dimension to this discussion, and a different dimension to this discussion. And I will say that this is something I have been thinking about very abstractly for a very long time, and have not had any tools or have been able to pin anybody down long enough to actually spend any time talking about this. So we're going to close the door, and that's it. Okay, so basically, the origin of eukaryotes, we've been talking a lot about sort of evolutionary processes out here, and these are the big sort of six supergroups of eukaryotes and the existing diversity of eukaryotes. And so that would be the first place, if people wanted, I could stop and do a slide on the diversity of eukaryotes, just so we have some sense of what we're talking about. Is that something that people would like to do?
Sure.
Yeah? Okay. it's a new laptop, so I'm also going to be technically incompetent as well as scientifically incompetent, so that's cool. Okay. Try that. Okay, so, and you'll all have to forgive me because I'm going to do this again in my lecture, but basically, the diversity of eukaryotes is broken up into six what are called supergroups, and that is an intentionally non-Linnaean rank, for reasons that are interesting to taxonomists and may or may not be interesting to the rest of us. What matters is that most of us, most of the cell biological information that we have, excluding bacteria and archaea, and so this is a eukaryotic focused problem, and I apologize to you too. This is a map. You are here. These are animals. So us, mice, HeLa cells, C. elegans, Drosophila, and so all in that one group, and then Nicole's group is here, and then interesting lineages, single-celled relatives of animals. Also in this same group are fungi. And so then, so when you sort of read papers, when people try to make a nod towards evolution, they go, something is conserved from yeast to man. That's still a single supergroup. Okay? So then we can just kind of go sort of clockwise around this circle. So these are the excavates, and there's some interesting things that have been happening recently about the root of eukaryotes in the excavates.
What is Opisthoconta
means rear-facing flagellum. So these, yeah, that's what it means. And so what this
rear.
Means is that
Well,
it's a, so,
not weird.
So these names come from, well, they come from a couple of different places. There are both morphological and molecular traits that unite, that have been used to pull together these relationships. And so what fungi and animals, cells, have in common is that they have an organization where they, if you squint and look, try not to think about the exceptions too much, single basal body, and when they swim, either basically the cell is coming out the back, right? So these are, or you're stationary and the cell's on it, sitting on its head, and it's coming out the front, right? So coanos use this to generate a current to feed, or sperm cells swim this way, and chytrid fungi go this way. And that's the morphological trait that unites these groups. Okay? Excavates, similarly, have a unique set of cytoskeletal structures that actually that are used to build a feeding groove. So, and it really does look, when you look at it sort of head on, it really looks like somebody took a scoop and just excavated something out of the surface of the cell.
So are all these guys now believed to be modified, like the super groups that you have up here?
Okay, so I'm kind of hoping this is.
You can just skip that.
No. Okay, so this is an older, this is a slightly older slide. This is a 2011 slide. There have been some interesting things since then. One to do with the root of the tree, where we now think the root of eukaryotes goes, which actually seems to go inside these guys. And so that excavate organization seems to have been ancestral to eukaryotes, because it's on both sides of the tree. And even more convincingly, when you look at the actual organization of the cytoskeleton and the flagellum across eukaryotes, actually, that's the most complete form, but everybody's got the same basic organization. And so those two data sets actually work out together. So excavates are not monophyletic, but that's because the root may go within them. The other complication, and I'll just get there in a sec, Andrew, archaeplastida, so that's basically, that is green algae, red algae, and glaucophytes. So glaucophytes are these really interesting sort of basal lineage to both of these, and their plastids, their photosynthetic organelles actually still have peptidoglycan. So they really do seem to be really kind of ancient and cool. And here's the other exception to this, which is these guys. And so you can see there's two of them here that are just basically, I wish they were acronyms. They're just basically the first letter of each of the component lineages. So it is unclear, even using the biggest data sets that we can assemble right now, whether these lineages are related to one another or are not. And so there's some people who are very hot and bothered about whether that's the case and so on. Each of these, even if they're not, they're definitely in this grouping. So maybe some of them are up here and some of them are down here. But these are really important organisms, like, my favorite one is the haptophytes. And so these are things like Emiliania. And again, I'll show, if I do a longer version of this diversity talk, which we had talked about potentially doing, these guys make, who put up a picture of Emiliania? Somebody did already. It was the thing that looked like a tennis ball that was put up. So these things are wonderful. And if you'll bear with me for like 1 second, this picture is worth finding. Okay, sorry. I hadn't planned on giving this lecture at all. That guy. Okay, so this is Emiliana Huxleyi. So from a cell biology point of view, they do super cool things because they make these scales, which are regular, complicated, and basically pooped out by the Golgi. So somehow these things are nanofabricating within the cell. It's a membrane trafficking problem and it's a biomineralization problem. The scales, to some extent, in some cases, are larger than the size of the cell body itself. And so they're also about 6 microns in diameter. This is a satellite image. These things can form blooms of hundreds of thousands of kilometers across and can be seen using regular satellite imagery from space. So haptophytes are really cool and really interesting and really not closely related to anything else that we really know about at all. So there's that. And then back to that slide. Sorry. Okay, and then the SAR group, which stands for straminopiles, alveolates, and rhizaria. And so these are things like plasmodium, or toxoplasma. So plasmodium causes malaria, kills about 1 million people a year, mostly kids in Africa. You have straminopiles, so these are things like diatoms, so like 20% of the world's carbon fixation worldwide is from diatoms, so oceanographically, ecologically really important. Rhizaria are this other group of organisms, and we're just starting to really understand their relevance, but they're a big diverse group. And then the last one, and I've been doing this clockwise, not by evolutionary relationships particularly, are the amoebozoa. So these are things like Dictyostelium, which I think the students are playing with this week in the lab, but also things like Entamoeba histolytica, which causes amoebic dysentery, which kills a mere 100,000 people a year. So they're really important organisms, and they're diverse organisms. And so that, when we talk about sort of eukaryotes, and this is sort of my perspective, and so I try to reconstruct traits that are back across all of these things and at the ancestor. And so then the question is, to sort of go back to the original sort of part of this, which was, there we go. I haven't even gotten to my first slide yet. We have this astonishing diversity. We can reconstruct back to a very complicated last common ancestor of all of those existing groups, which is what I'll talk about in my lecture. And then we have this, the first common ancestor of eukaryotes. And I think that's what I want to talk about. So how do you go from happily living as a non-compartmentalized, probably smaller cell, doing biosynthesis, biosynthetic metabolism, how do you go to something that is a eukaryote? Yep.
I know this is not the subject of the talk, but this tree issue, and for people who are not experts on it, which
right.
we were not when we started. So when we started the project, it was going to take 1 or 2 years. We kept feeling that the sand was just shifting under our feet, and
yeah.
the tree kept on changing. And I realized after a while that it doesn't really matter, because a lot of the messages don't change, given a lot of the detailed stuff that people are arguing about.
Depending, well, I think that's question dependent. I think that's question dependent. I think a vastly alternate route for eukaryotes would make a big difference.
Might happen?
I don't think it's going to happen, but roots that have been rejected recently was at the base of, like, at the base of animals and fungi. Mm-hmm. That makes a huge difference based on, you know, there's all sorts of genes that are present in animals and fungi but not present elsewhere. If you put the root at the base of that, then they were maybe in the ancestor. If it's anywhere else on the tree, then they were clearly gained afterwards. Yeah.
Are you just looking across these different supergroups and saying which organelles are,
Well, mostly this is a drawing. Mostly this is just kind of a drawing for me to illustrate.
I just know you
big sweeping back in time. No, we did put quite a bit of thought into this diagram, which is to basically say, we're pretty sure based on both the presence of molecular components and the presence of electron microscopy data that certain features are present in all eukaryotes and therefore were likely in the ancestor. And so, for example, mitochondria, right? Present across supergroups, cristae. We just had a paper that showed that the machinery involved in making cristae present across eukaryotes and probably brought in by the alpha proteobacteria, stacked Golgi similarly, multivesicular bodies similarly, so that kind of thing. But the crux here is how, why, and in what order of events would you go from something like this to something like this, which seems to me to be a major jump. And so I'm getting ahead of myself. I'm thinking that if you had a model where you had a very small population size and started dealing with bottlenecks, or you moved into a virgin ecosystem, that would allow that kind of massive shift to survive. So let me just kind of go on beyond my first slide. So the one thing that I want to talk about, you know, origin and timing of eukaryotic features, and it would be useful to sort of brainstorm what features might we want to talk about. I have a list, but we can go on. The other point, I try really hard not to say because the standard language, the easy language, is the prokaryote to eukaryote transition. And I've started being a little bit more careful about that because Anthony Poole wrote a really nice paper pointing out where the gist of the paper was, you cannot just look at existing prokaryotes and assume that, you know, that there's been no evolution on those lines. There's been a ton of evolution along those lines as well, and that wasn't what we meant to be doing. What we were talking about was, how do you go from a state where you have no Golgi or endomembrane compartment or mitochondria to one that does? And that's all we mean by that transition. And then you can start talking about polarized things like some of the models do, and we'll get into in a second, where you go from modern prokaryotic traits, figure out what was present, and then build a eukaryote from that. So that's two different things. And I don't think it's practical or useful to do the modern prokaryote biology then turns into eukaryotic biology 1.5 billion years ago, particularly. That's not a game that I think is all that useful to play, but it might be. Okay. The reason that we can talk about this non-compartmentalized to compartmentalized state is that we do seem to have multiple lines of evidence suggesting that eukaryotes are more recent than either of the two prokaryotic lineages, right? And that comes from a couple of different types of evidence. So we have things that are arguably good bacterial or archaeal microfossils, and you have things that are arguably good eukaryotic ones, and the most convincing eukaryotic ones are 1.4 to 1.6 billion years old, and the bacterial ones are a lot older than that. And you never see anything that looks like a eukaryote beyond, the one that I'm familiar with that's most convincing is the 1.6 billion year old one, and you go, okay, that is definitely, it's big, it's got processes, it's a eukaryote. Anything older than that, you start really having problems. Biomarkers, so chemicals that are only made by eukaryotes, again, show up versus chemical signatures that are made by prokaryotes, bacteria or archaea. They are present in rock far older than that, whereas eukaryotic ones only show up around the same time as we start seeing the microfossils. And similarly, if you start doing molecular clocks on existing eukaryotic genes, you sort of, these models all coalesce to that same basically 1.5 plus or minus a little bit billion years old. Right, so three multiple lines of evidence. Yes?
I show up for 2 seconds.
Of course. You missed, I said a whole big thing about coenophagellates.
And sorry, I was sorry. I lost track of time, honestly. So I'm going to be crank again.
Yeah.
The first three things, I feel like microfossils, I worry about whether that actually tells you anything, because eukaryotic, biomarkers again,
Well, so the biomarker one, so we're actually writing a paper with Roger Buick, who's been doing a lot of this stuff right now, and there was that one biomarker paper that put eukaryotes a lot deeper than that.
I guess I should say that I don't disagree.
And Roger has a very interesting paper that will be coming up soon, and he will say something about that.
Okay.
It's online, so I can't say anything that's not. Anyway, I think everything might work out.
I don't disagree with the argument that they're likely later. I think probably the chimeric, But the first three, I just think the more, sorry, Roger, but,
We'll figure out a way to edit things.
It was that he announced this in March, and he actually asked for an embargo on that in that room. So I don't know what to say, but it's all going to work out.
Molecular clocks, we can't calibrate them. Microfossils.
No, I agree. I think what we can definitely say is that eukaryotes, there seems to be good evidence that they were around at 1.5 billion years old.
Yes, and we don't know how much older.
And we don't know how much older they were, and certainly that also depends on what you call a eukaryote and when do we start. I mean, these are things that look like modern eukaryotes, right? I mean, the Bangiomorpha fossil, which looks almost indistinguishable, and this is, again, a slide I put up in my class, and I say, I should really try and colorize this properly, because the images give it away. You put up a picture of the modern Bangia, you put up a picture of the 1.2 billion year old Bangia morpha fossil, and the students are pretty much 50-50 split on which one's the fossil and which one's modern. I mean, it's really, really cool. But yes, so I completely agree with you that this is where the crux of the data is, and it's the most convincing argument, because eukaryotes look like both prokaryotes and, sorry, both bacteria and archaea, and that there are differential aspects of that. And if you start with a eukaryote first, then you have to imagine A, all the things about how you get all these things, and then how you would differentially divide up into these two lineages afterwards. Okay? So, this idea of multiple lineage contribution to eukaryotes. So most people, I think, are familiar with the idea that there's an archaeal connection to eukaryotic origins. How many people are familiar with that? 1, 2, 3, most people?
Maybe not.
No?
How many not?
How many not? How many have never heard that before? Okay. So, when you start doing comparisons between eukaryotic genes and both archaeal and bacterial genes, some interesting patterns arise. When you just start doing what's the closest relative, you get lots of archaeal stuff. And these are all the sort of housekeeping nuclear genes, so replication, transcription, translation, they all seem to come from archaea. Right? So we use archaeal systems and not bacterial systems. And so in many cases, you actually use these as the root. And so it's this common idea that an archaeal lineage, whether it was a sister lineage or an internal lineage, gave rise to eukaryotes through some event, right? That's our great-grandparents. And then this is the one sort of slide about the Loki archaea, and we'll talk a little bit more about this. This was a paper that came out, I think, in May, basically, where they seem to have found the archaeal lineage that is the sister group to eukaryotes to the exclusion of all other archaea. So it goes us, these guys, everybody else. And in support of that, there are features that had, so cell biological features or protein, no, so let me rephrase that, proteins that are thought to encode cell biological machinery that had never been seen outside of eukaryotes that are found in this organism. And they did various types of controls and to make sure that this was not like a misassembly, this was not some sort of bioinformatic error, that they'd actually incorporated eukaryotes in this and so on. Okay, so eukaryotes, Loki archaea, and so on. And so what's nice is that we potentially have a candidate for where the archaeal contributions come from.
So have they named, I've been saying they should name this TACLE, and they haven't done it yet.
TACLE?
T-A-C-K-L-E.
Oh, that'd be great. Yeah, I have no idea. I don't know what they're...
Now we accept this, right? Is this done?
No.
I don't know who's... Yeah.
So the question is whether these was contamination, that's the problem.
Well, so why do you think it's contamination? What are the arguments for that?
I'm just telling you.
Okay.
Because
I was very concerned. I was very concerned until we started working with these guys on these data, which I'll be presenting in a couple of slides next week. And the key one for me, so what they did was they basically took a scoop of mud and sequenced everything from it. And then they managed to assemble up this archaeal genome. And they did not find a single 18S gene. So it's not like there were lots of eukaryotes in the environment and they misassembled this guy together. There are no 18S genes whatsoever, suggesting that that these few eukaryotic-like things aren't sort of misassembly from eukaryotes that were around at the time. So to me, that's the most convincing data.
So I'm just going to check. That implies that these are organisms that have not yet been cultured.
That's right. They have no culture. They have, and it's not even necessarily a, I don't think it's a closed, complete genome. It's not an organism, it's a set of metagenomic data that is all sort of internally consistent and coherent, but that has, so when you look at these proteins, if they were eukaryotic ones, they should go with the specific eukaryotic subgroups. They really do look like archaeal versions of what are then diversified protein families in eukaryotes. Or if you do that, they're always at the base. If it was a contaminant, you'd think it was, well, it's an existing eukaryotic contaminant, so it should be inside.
So yeah. The protein people play this game, right? They're supposed to guess the structure of a protein from the sequence.
Okay.
Plus, Bob has suggested that this is very nice. If you really know vaguely what we're doing, we should be able to guess what Loki archaea look like well before somebody cultures them. I think this is a game that's worth thinking about. It gives us something to shoot.
Yeah. Yep. And I wanted to put this up only because it's the latest best guess on the archaeal contributor. Before we found out about this, I had Steve Kelly's paper up about the thom archaea, because they were really good, right? And that was a really nice paper. And what's nice is that these guys are in the same basic group as the thom archaea, and they have many of the same features, mesophilic, and so on and so forth. So
do you really mean like what does it look like, or do you mean like could a living organism?
Could there be
a living organism that had only those proteins in it? Those predicted proteins.
I guess something about the biology which is unusual, different from
I think the other important part about this is there's so much emphasis about its eukaryotic nature. It's not really. I mean, it's really a fairly standard-looking archaea. It just happens to have these extra eukaryotic things that are really surprising. And so I think most of the things that you would find about it are archaeal features. And I mean, that's my understanding of this genome. I've been focusing on a very small subset of these proteins.
And not to mention, it lives 3 kilometers below the surface, and so who knows what that does to its biology.
Exactly, yeah.
Can you say anything about cell wall, pseudo-peptidoglycan?
I don't think you can say anything. Well, let me phrase that. I can't say anything about that because I don't know, and we had talked about trying to get the first author of this paper out here for this program, and she's still thinking.
I think they have a substantial fraction of the genome, as I recall.
Oh yeah, no, they do. But whether it encodes the proteins that you're interested in, I don't know.
Well,
the sequence is available.
The reason is it's hard to imagine anything that has a cell wall engulfing something else. Right, so like a modern day bacterium that's a peptidoglycan all around its surface.
Yeah, and we can talk about some of the models where people are proposing exactly that.
Yeah. I guess I'm jumping ahead of where you are, but you know, how is something else going to get in there?
Right.
So
well,
the presence of a cell wall.
Or whether that's necessarily the relevant. So yeah, we will definitely get into, I hope, if we get into these kinds of questions. So the other point, though, is it's not just a straight shot, you know, archaea then just turned into eukaryotes, because when you, so the first thing, way before people started sequencing genomes, there's this problem that bacteria and eukaryotes build their membranes in the same way, and archaea use a completely different sort of, they use an ether linkage instead of an ester linkage. And so that needs to be explained somehow. And when you have these models where eukaryotes and bacteria were sister taxa, eukaryotes and archaea were sisters, then it was easy, because you just said, well, fine, so archaea just lost it and we're done, right? Single change. But if you're now going to say that eukaryotes came from well embedded within archaea, then that's a problem, right? So that has to be explained from a cell biological point of view. And then you have this issue that some genes, many genes, let me just finish my sentence and we'll come to you. Actually, their closest relative isn't archaeal, it's bacterial. They clearly come from bacterial ancestry. And that these tend to be metabolic genes. Right? So, yeah.
Can I just ask something more? When you say things like Archaea use fatty ether linkages, how broad should I think? Should I think every Archaea we know fatty ether?
I think there are possibly better people in the room to answer that than me. I tend to think in that sort of large generalization. There may be some exceptions, but I'm not aware of them.
There's only one ether-linked lipid ever found in any eukaryote. It's present in some funny cell type.
No, but the other way around is presumably what's more important, right? Like, not so much that there's only one known eukaryote, but how...
My understanding is that these are... In terms of using ester linkages?
Yeah, and unfortunately,
okay, well, I think that would be really important to know, because that might also help to pinpoint, right? I mean, if it turned out that, say, for example, Loki you made ester linkages, then that would be a difference. But I don't know, can somebody who, people, you know, the bacterial or archaeal people in the room weigh in on that?
There's another difference, too, and that is which hydroxyl group will the glycerol stuff gets
right, yeah. Yeah, the chirality of the glycerol triphosphate backbone.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, and that's, again, that's a differential thing. And how does it go? Does it go bacteria, eukaryotes, and archaea different?
It's a thing.
Archaea are different from the...
Yeah, okay.
I use this in the first lecture in my class. I give it to the students and ask them to figure out what the membrane of the last universal common ancestor looked like.
Right.
And that messes up their heads.
Yeah, but the problem is that we just don't, because we don't know how it works, right? Yeah, yeah. And I'll just ignore that one for a second. So then the question is, if there's clearly been some sort of bacterial contributor, what might that be? Like, what's the best guess for that? And we know one bacteria that we know was present very, very long ago in a very important association with eukaryotes is obviously the alpha proteobacteria, right? And so this is what gave rise to the mitochondria. People are familiar with that story. Everybody here should be familiar with that story. Okay, cool. And so some theories of the origin of eukaryotes use this as a crucial or the only founding event, and other types of theories say, well, yeah, really important, that's great, but it's not the singular founding event, and maybe there was somebody else.
Can I also, when you say that all eukaryotic cells that we understand today have mitochondria,
okay,
are none of them capable of producing the same sort of like ATP generating system outside of the mitochondria? Is that also to an implicit argument that mitochondria are the only source of the ATP synthesis, for example? Or not the ATP synthesis.
I think there's other ways. There's certainly other ways of generating ATP.
No, that's not.
But homologous to this system, yeah.
They're only mitochondria.
Yeah, just there's... And all of the existing sort of divergent forms of mitochondrial-derived organisms they're all related to the single mitochondrial endosymbiosis.
That's the way I've always taught it.
Yeah.
But I have heard some rumblings that there might have been that they were all alpha proteobacteria, that you can't rule out the possibility that...
Certainly when you do the trees, they all go together. I mean, all mitochondrial things, they all go together. I think it would be difficult to, given that we don't have the full diversity of existing proteobacteria, you might be able, you know, if there were two versions of that, mm-hmm. but there's sort of, you know, there's no evidence for it, and so there's no reason to put in that kind of complicated ghost hypothesis at this stage.
So what is the...
people like Michael Gray,
This is his shopping. No, this isn't the shopping bag hypothesis. There's something else.
I don't know. There's this idea that there was this special point in time where the proto-eukaryote and alpha proteobacteria were in community, and that you can't rule out the possibility that there might have been two or more independent
invisible. Does he have any? Because I missed his talk when he gave that a couple of years ago in Vancouver. Is there any data for that, or is it kind of a thought experiment?
It must have been interesting enough for me to remember it.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, no, Mike is a super interesting and super smart guy, so.
So what happened to the other one?
Plausible.
It got absorbed into the new.
Did it get absorbed, or did it just get shuffled out?
Yeah, it looks like you have seen.
No, I haven't seen the talk, but I heard the discussion, but there's a couple of things about it. First of all, even if it did happen, because bacteria have been exchanging genes ever since then, we wouldn't be able to pinpoint one or two. But the other thing is, if it had happened this way, there was a population, and I actually buy this, so there was a population and it was a close association, and it might have happened multiple times. Still, by the process of genetic drift and sampling, only one of those would be ancestral, something like that.
Right, and that's exactly, this is exactly where I would like this discussion to go, is taking principles like that, and how do we apply it to deal with exactly this kind of thing, right? So when people put in sorts of, this could be possible sort of explanations, I mean, we have a much more recent one about potentially multiple origins of plastids.
But right? It seems like the important thing here is that this must be a field where the constant application of Occam's razor is a useful counterbalance to people wishing to gain publicity by being contrarian.
True, except that there have been enough very high profile cases where Occam's razor fails spectacularly that people can then stand up and say anything they want and go, but look, it didn't work in that case. And I'm not naming any names.
Occam's razor is not guaranteed to work.
No.
It's probabilistically true that it works more often than not.
I completely agree. It's what we use first all the time, unless you have evidence otherwise, and then you build the best theory based on the new evidence, right?
But it's really a profoundly important question in all evolutionary issues, including the origin of life on Earth, which is, whether there was just one highly improbable event that led to life on Earth, or whether life on Earth evolved multiple times and just got extinguished by meteors, multiple times. This is the same kind of argument.
Yeah.
Is this one extremely rare lucky event, or did it happen multiple times and then?
Yeah.
To maximize my reputation as an asshole, it's not science if it's not falsified, right? Some of these things are just not science because we're not going to know.
Yeah.
And there is nothing about the evidence that is available to us today that will enable us with anything approaching certainty to say how things happen. And I think it's really important that we be critical about this. Because otherwise, it's just horrible.
Yep, no, I agree. And one of the nice things that you can say, certain hypotheses make specific predictions, right? I mean, Lynn Margulis's hypothesis that the flagella was a symbiotic spirochete bacterium made very clear predictions, which you can then go out and test, and did not come through, and then you can say, falsified. Great, move on. I completely agree with you. And I think that one of the beautiful things about this particular example is that it had very clear predictions about what types of, about the phylogenetic trees you should build, and the first time they built them, they worked exactly that way. Right, the gene from the mitochondria was supposed to go not with the eukaryotic place from where it was isolated, but with an alpha protean bacterium. That's what they did. That's what they found. Done. Right.
I really think Nicole's point still is very important to make, which is that many people, if they read textbooks, think that it was one cell that went into one cell and that was everything. And that's not the Occam's razor solution. In fact, that's a very, very odd type of solution. Right? The right solution should be populations, and that's, even if we can't measure it, we should keep it in mind.
Well, I guess that's what I was trying to say. I mean, I'm not a population geneticist, but one thing that I'm interested in is this idea of lineage sorting and population
absolutely.
At the root of
and bottlenecks and
so
Which is, I'm glad, because you guys have now just made my point of why we're having this discussion, because it's exactly this kind of thing that we need to be talking about.
I don't know about plausibility.
I'm going to just put something up really fast because I probably won't get to it, but it's really relevant. So this is a table summarizing a paper by Maureen O'Malley, who is a philosopher of science, sociologist of science, and she wrote this great paper summarizing the two types of theory about the origin of eukaryotes. And she said there's phagotrophic theories and syntrophic theories, which I've got slides and we can talk about those and summarize those. But she said, if you look at these two types of theories, one of the reasons why there's fundamental disagreements is on epistemology and on what people are prioritizing. So if you prioritize explanations that nicely explain the cell biology but aren't so good on the genomics, then it tends to go one way. Whereas if what you really care about is solving that genomic chimerism problem, then you may not even include some of the cell biological data, and you'll tend to go for the syntrophic theories instead. And what I think is really interesting is this one, right? Are you prioritizing plausibility, which if you assume sort of a single cataclysmic event, plausibility is all that matters because it only had to happen maybe once? Or are you prioritizing probability? Well, this is a likely event, and therefore it's going to happen more and more times. And this is a really nice, it's a beautiful paper.
What's the name of the author?
Maureen O'Malley. She's in Sydney. And I can send you the paper because I teach a whole class on this. It's a great paper. Gradual versus stochastic models, et cetera, right? And it's a great opportunity to get students thinking about, this is how I sneak philosophy of science into a medical school curriculum. Now it's on film. All right, so, that's okay, my chair's okay with it. So just to mention, there are at least some other interesting and provocative bacteria that might have been around. So basically the argument is, some people think all you need is the alpha proteobacterial contributor to explain all of the bacterial contribution. And other people go, well, actually, there's no reason to say that that has to be the case. And some people have gone very explicit and said, what about this guy? And I'm more in the camp to say, maybe there was somebody else in the room. And I'll just leave it at that, because I don't know who that was. But I'm not happy with an explanation where the alpha proteobacteria was necessarily the only bacterial contributor. And this is another way of potentially solving the lipid problem. If a bacterium was the one that did the phagocytosing to then bring in an archaea, that might fix it. I'm not saying it did fix it, I'm saying it might fix it, right? Okay, so what do we need to account for? And this is where I think we can right. So you've got to account for some sort of cell biology, right? And there's a list of traits that eukaryotes have that we are interested in and we want to have explanations for. And that would be things like the membrane trafficking system, and then you get into my specialized area of interest, which is the different endomembrane organelles and how did that happen and whatever. Mitochondria, the nucleus, the flagellum, the centrosome, so on. Genome architecture, introns, and then the machinery associated with that. Physiological capabilities, right? So is that could be metabolism, that could be meiosis and syngamy, and I don't know which one. It's not an organelle, but it is cell biology, right? But what do you do? How do you get that? Where does it come from? And most importantly, what order? Can we say something about the order? If you get one, does that make the next thing more likely, right? I mean, Rob's not here with the allostery thing, but this is essentially evolutionary allostery, right? And then you've also got to kind of have the rest of the data, right? This is to get a theory that best fits all of the data. So the genome signatures, it's data out there, you've got to have a theory that explains this, right? Taking into account the environment, right? And so different people have different theories about where the origin of eukaryotes took place, and that puts some potential constraints or adds potential variables to the model, right? So if you're in a hydrothermal vent, that's one thing. If you're in a small pond, that's something else. If you're at the bottom of the ocean, that's something else, right? And then there's this point, which is inertia, right? So if you are existing in a good selected solution to exit to a given environment, and then you're going to evolve something vastly different, how does that happen? And this is, again, one of the things where I think population genetics can help. So either there's a massive selective pressure, or there's some sort of cataclysm or catastrophe, and you happen to be the only solution that was at very, very low frequency and terrible, but not dead, and then you're the new solution to the new problem. Or you just happen to be the only guy standing, right? And that's possible too, right? So this is what I'm hoping. Adding a dimension of rigor to an area where there has been a great deal of hand-waving. So can we put some numbers on this? Can we put some ranges, right? And so this question of, you know, the energetics of genome complexity, whether you like the paper, whether you like the conclusions of the paper or not, one thing that I think was done very nicely is that they really did try to do some calculations, right? They tried to put some rigor to this question. And I think that is worthy of note and worthy of praise. This is the Martin, is it Lane and Martin or Martin and Lane? Lane and Martin paper in Nature in 2010, where they tried to calculate the energetic cost of having a large genome. And the conclusion was you can't power a large genome in the absence of a mitochondria, and therefore mitochondria had to have been the singular thing that gave you eukaryoticness, right? And there's been lots of debate for and against, and I'm not going to say I'm on neither side of the paper. It's a really interesting paper, but what I really do think is worthy of note in a positive way is that they did calculations and tried to put some rigor to this. Okay, so I think we can do this in two ways, and you, if you didn't hear Mike's talk, you should hear Mike's talk because it was also really cool, and so on. So there's two ways to go with this. One is to just kind of do an a priori, what are the questions that we should think about and how might population genetics help, which I think is the more interesting one. The other thing that would be possibly easier and I think goes down a really unpleasant potentially road is to say, well, what are some of the existing theories? And then you could say, well, what are some of the a priori ranges? Could we either put some bounds on the theories or just rule some of them out in the same way that we had done with, you know, Lin's theory makes a prediction about spirochete genes, there's no spirochete genes, toss that theory out, right? I think that could be done. I'm not sure that's not what I'm interested in doing necessarily, but it would be a good discussion if we have time. So, a priori questions. I don't know if now is a good time to try to come up with a list of traits that the room thinks is interesting to maybe want to try to incorporate into a theory, or, yeah? This was just me brainstorming.
So, I mean, one of the things I struggle with when thinking about things as long ago as origin of eukaryotes is how do you estimate population size, generation times?
Thank God, somebody else talk. I have no idea.
Yeah.
You know,
in a way that's
important. The only way is we have to estimate NE right now, and it's good for four NE generations. So,
okay, but
it's with polymorphism data, and there's no polymorphisms from a billion years ago.
But you gave some really good ranges, right?
All you can base it on what you see in today's origin.
Yeah. But I mean, the existing, you know, all single-celled eukaryotes that we see are within a range of, what, two orders of magnitude, right? Something like that? All prokaryotic things are in another range.
Probably said it was never bigger than 10 to 11.
Okay, but so that's never bigger.
I guess what you're going to want is how small it was.
Or even what kinds of things in the different theories, if you talk about a big population turning into another big population or a very small population then turning into a big population, how does that change the types of theories that we can talk about without necessarily having to calculate exact numbers, right?
Can I have a related question. Given that you want to generate theories and presumably falsify them, or at least attempt to falsify them, what sort of experiments do we actually have to bring to bear? I guess that's something I'm struggling with right now. What is data here in some tangible way that I can see? I understand the trees argument. Okay, so you have sequences, you build common sequences, you build trees. Mm-hmm. At some point, your sequences disappear. Presumably, you have only sequences of today, and you are relying on some noise that travels back up to 1.5 billion years ago. Is there other forms of data, like?
Sure.
But, so, you're assuming that sequences all evolve uniformly in time and across the
system? No, which I understand the constraints, but
so,
I'm saying
no, no, but the fact is that because we have so much new eukaryotic diversity, you will find lots of proteins or bits of proteins or entire systems have not changed in 2 billion years. And so you can actually measure how they behave today because they still exist in essentially unchanged form beyond this, for example, 75% identity threshold we heard about this morning. They probably bind to the same stuff. They exist today. So you can study these living fossils. Second thing is, nothing says that the actual processes have changed. Right? So you can do the experiments.
Part of the thing, so I would say that you can reconstruct back to the last common ancestor of eukaryotes. That is a different thing than talking about the origin of eukaryotes. And I think that's something that isn't often appreciated. We can, you can use exactly the process that you talk about and say, well, okay, everybody that we've looked at has this protein that's involved in trafficking from the cis Golgi to the intermediate Golgi. Everybody's got it. We can recognize it. That's a feature of the last common ancestor. What I'm talking about is actually going through what must have been both a long time and a lot of biological change to go from a much less complicated state through some iterations. And again, I'll talk about the kind of iteration model that we have to get a membrane trafficking system, to go from a first founding event. After the founding event, to get to the last common ancestor, it's that founding event that I think is really, really baffling. And so people are relying on things like plausibility versus probability, known ecological interactions, and that kind of thing. And this is where I'm actually hoping that, or asking the question. I mean, maybe this is completely a dead end, right? We can all just go and have coffee now. But could we, I agree, there is a paucity of data here. Can we use principles or tools in population genetics to give some more, either different types of data or more rigor to the question? Boris, are you?
I couldn't answer that. Not all the questions, including interesting ones, are guaranteed to have answers, right? And I think questions have been raised by some in this room already about whether population genetics in particular can offer some miracle answers here, right? You know, population size and effective population size and all of this is kind of wonderful, but actually the big elephant in the room is selection.
Mm-hmm.
So presumably a lot of these processes were driven by selection, for we do not quite know what.
Right.
So, but, and another question in the room is, again, these are very interesting questions of sort of natural history, diversity, and the concern that some of us are also very eager to understand the dynamics, evolutionary dynamics that drive these processes, and not necessarily the history. Right?
Sure.
But just understanding what evolution can do to sort of complexify the system going forward in time, right?
Yeah.
And then suddenly we can very easily start answering Sri's questions, you know, what are the experiments that we can do, and there just seems to me like much easier landscape of problems to navigate. You know, this morning we were hearing about the transcription factor specificity, and there was some notion that 35% of the protein sort of has to be substituted before anything significant changes, which some of us probably would question and think that you can get substantial change with a few mutations, which of course doesn't contradict that looking at the tree, a lot of this
35% substitutions didn't happen as kind of a clock, but I'm not particular. Anyway, I'm just rambling here, right? But I'm sort of very eager to, you know, like young three here, to latch on to sort of sharp questions that we can take to the students back there and start doing experiments.
So, trying to think of how to. So.
That was a rant.
No. It's not that. I think that there are, in terms of sharp questions. This is admittedly a very, very vague thing because I've been dissatisfied with the process that has happened so far. Right. So people do write papers, and they are very high profile and very hotly debated papers where pretty much all they do, not all they do. They do a very good job, and they put lots of details behind them, but they really hinge on a single selective advantage. They say, I think the selective reason that we have the origin of eukaryotes is this. And then they kind of flesh out the theory, but then I think those kinds of theories could actually be the sharp question. Well, does that give a testable prediction? How could we test that? And some people do that and some people don't, and so on. I'm wondering, for example, if you could use population genetics. The one I was thinking of was, what difference does it make to scenarios of the origin of eukaryotes if you evolve the ability to do meiosis early, right? In that sort of order of things, you go, well, okay, so we've got to have mitochondria, you've got to have an endomembrane system. You gotta have a mitochondria, or you gotta have whatever.
So are you talking about sex in reproduction, or sex as in genetic exchange?
No, sex is in reproduction, as in that's right. Yeah. No. So gene flow, and a lot of this actually had to do with gene flow, because I started thinking about these things in a lab that was studying horizontal gene transfer. So that's one way of doing gene flow. If eukaryotes don't do horizontal gene transfer. Let's say very loosely, let's maybe an order of magnitude less than bacteria and archaea, that means that then you're cut off. You're reproductively isolated, right? You're potentially now you've landed on a Hawaiian island, right? And you're cut off from everybody else you were trading genes with. What does that do? Now, all of a sudden, but say then you evolve the capacity for both sex, so both meiosis to get rid of genes, to get rid of mutations, but then also syngamy, so that if you do get a cytoplasmic change, say a mitochondria, that could sweep to fixation. Or genes can sweep to fixation because you can selectively sweep them. They don't have to just beat each other out in a competitive way, right? Versus say that's a really hard thing to evolve, and you've got to evolve genome size, then chromosomes, then mitosis, then meiosis, so it's a really late thing. What does that do to our models, right? And the answer is I don't know the math or the theory to be able to do that. I'm hoping I'm identifying questions that are interesting. I have no solutions and haven't since.
That's my background from the very beginning, is just to find it broadly. When people have measured, you can measure now the rate of recombination in bacteria relative to the mutation rate.
Mm-hmm.
It scales, it's roughly a ratio of 1.
Okay.
And it's the same number within, you know, a factor of 3 or 4. It's the same as you get in meiotic eukaryotes. So I think what's occasionally evolved are like parthenogenetic lineages that have really lost any recombination.
Okay. Yeah.
But, you know, bacteria are all sexual. And there's some are extraordinary.
But in what way? Right. And this also has to do with ploidy
numbers. Meiosis, but it's still exchanging. I'm not talking about horizontal transfer.
Right, you're talking about
whole-scale
transfer of gene between closely related things.
Within the species,
right?
So the example is that there's exactly what Mike just said. There's a tremendous one. So Heliobacter pylori exchanges genetic information within the same species at about the same frequency. And sexual eukaryotes do, so recombination is far more frequent than mutation. You look at natural isolates of E. coli, the reverse is true.
Okay.
The mutation is much more frequent than recombination, so there's some range across.
But I think that's good because.
I'm just thinking that that's what the data is. I mean, protein.
Right, and I think that already means that you can now rule out going down certain decision paths when you think about these theories, right? So now, the assumption would be that from the very, very beginning, whatever advantage that you would get from evolving meiosis in that way, you can say was probably already happening from the beginning and not something that you then have to add into the model afterwards, right? That would be different. So that means that certain, so one of the questions I was asked was, if you've got all these eukaryotic traits, why don't you see them, you know, one in this lineage, one in that lineage, one in the other, and it kind of has to do with trait stacking, right? That they all ended up in the same lineage at some point, which then gave rise to us, right? So if genetic exchange allows you to sweep very quickly through a population, that facilitates trait stacking, right? I'm looking at Mike. Is that correct?
It's not the only way.
No, it's not the only way, but it means that it is a way that works that would have been available to the early eukaryotes, whereas I think a lot of models would go, well, meiosis is something you do late, so therefore you can't access that or include that in your model. So I think that's what I mean by putting some constraints on things.
You may have addressed this a little earlier, but one of the things presumably you need to do for that is you need to build a comparative age graph for current prokaryotes as well, right? Because you need something about what is available at.
Yeah. Yep. And I don't know where the I don't know at all where those are where the field is at with that. I don't know if anybody's doing it. Yeah.
I'm not doing it. I have a question that is super naive. If you were to just take the saturation or rarefaction curve of metagenome stuff that's being sequenced over time, what does that look like right now? If you were to go out and pick some mud somewhere and just sequence a ton of stuff, you know, what fraction of those sequences and proteins have we ever seen before? You know, the reason I ask this is because I wonder if some of these problems could, from an outsider's perspective, be easier just from a comparative data set problem, if it's a sampling issue rather than it is a not thinking hard enough issue.
Well, yeah, so for eukaryotes or for bacteria and archaea or both, all of them?
I guess I'm interested in each of those answers.
Okay, right. So I think it's fair to say that there has not been a good new discovery of a big eukaryotic, I mean, there's nothing at the sort of like the supergroup level.
Okay.
For as long as I can remember, there have been individual sort of interesting bugs, and there have been some very interesting new groups that clearly fit within. So the mast groups, the marine stromina piles that Ramon Massana has sort of been discovering and working on, that's a really big deal. I mean, it's a huge amount of diversity that we just didn't know was there, but there's really no question that they're stromina piles, right? There's the few individual kind of things like Colledictian that actually everybody knew about. They just hadn't bothered to sequence it, and it turns out it ends up in a really interesting place. But I think we had that microscopically for some time, that kind of thing. Prokaryotes, I don't know. I mean, Loki was pretty new and surprising, and nobody really knew what it was.
I'm just thinking about the fact that I think we're still at the point where each new eukaryotic genome, typically 30% of the genes can't be mutated.
Yeah.
So
yeah, and that's actually conservative, even that's even higher, maybe.
Yeah, so we may be doing okay on a gross scale in terms of taxonomic sampling, but I think in terms of genetic diversity, we still have a lot of
things. Yeah, no, I'd agree with that. I think in terms of what, well.
And I also wonder, I haven't looked carefully at the Terra Oceans data, but
I haven't yet, no, I haven't either. If there's something really, really new, Julius comes next week. No, he comes the day I leave. So if you're here, ask Julius Lukacs, that question. Because he was on the Tara Oceans cruise, and he was a big part of that paper. Cruise being a really euphemistic. I think he had the Northern Atlantic in November. I don't think anybody would describe it as a cruise, but fine, right?
What's the PSP?
Eukaryotic specific protein, right? And that was kind of going back, because that was the acronym that the Loki guys used, or sorry, maybe a eukaryotic signature protein, actually, I think, right? So I mean, we've been trying to use a completely different type of approach and data to answer this question, right? In what order did the endomembrane compartments evolve? But those we think are all related to one another, and so you can answer those in a different way.
What are the endomembrane compartments? Just so I know.
ER, Golgi, different types of endosomes, plasma membrane, and the transport pathways that link them all together.
Basically, everything that has a lipid membrane within the
not mitochondria.
No, not mitochondria.
Okay.
And that may or may not be related to the nucleus per se, and the flagellum. There's some sort of evolutionary relationship, and that's being teased out. But yeah, certainly things of endosymbiotic origin are separate, but would then need a separate and interesting evolutionary explanation how you would integrate two systems together. Okay, so. And before I leave this slide, I did want to ask about this idea of potentially moving to, I mean, so I was really intrigued, Andrew, by your slide about sort of the big fitness jump down is possible so long as you go somewhere where you have no competitors. Is that a fair summary of that slide?
Fair summary.
Okay. Because I had always wondered if you have a large enough change, like say phagocytosis, that it opened up a novel ecological niche, even though it initially had a big cost or was a rare genome, would that allow sort of, if you open up a new ecological niche, could that help in this kind of incredibly rare event sort of explanation? And what might the math look surrounding something like that? And I'm gonna just direct that straight at you.
So my idea about that is very hand-wavy idea, which is that when you're always supposed to be living in situations like this, is computing the balance of costs and benefits. And if something allows you to occupy a niche where there's very little competition, it effectively reduces the cost, because it's the costs of
right.
Other people are busy eating you or out competing you.
Yeah.
They're much higher. And I guess one of the things that I worked on my thing about trying to avoid hand waving lecture he gave on Tuesday, and you know, my feeling about it is, yeah, I'm always running around telling people not to wave their hands, but for some of these things, you know, like that argument that I just made, it's a hand waving argument, because we don't know what the environments where we, you know,
yeah.
We are like volunteers can be found, going to try and do laboratory experiments which are based on these ideas, but then there's no way of knowing in any sort of quantitative sense about how those can be extrapolated to nature. And
I don't think it's that much of a hand-waving argument. I think, I'm sorry to let you down.
I mean, it's quantitative in the sense if we knew what the costs and benefits were, as long as the benefits exceed the cost, this is plausible. I guess all I mean is it's really, really, really unclear, at least to me personally, how we have any way of estimating and producing information that allows us to estimate what those costs were in any particular situation. That's all I mean. And because of that, while I admire a lot the idea that you're putting forward that population genetics should be able to help, and I'm a fan of population genetics, you know, it's unclear, especially that far back when we have relatively few signatures, especially when we get to your thing about the first eukaryotic common ancestor. I mean, I'd love to be proved wrong.
But I think it's entirely possible. A lot of mutations are normally really bad, but occasionally you have that bad mutation and you land in the right spot, and it's not bad in that environment, it's actually good, and you're asexual and away you go.
What about
extreme phenotypes as having been promoted by natural selection from the very beginning.
So that's why I think this is not that unreasonable an argument.
Yeah, no, I guess I'm not saying that I think it's on, I mean, I made it sort of ugly, I think it's somewhat reasonable. But I guess what I'm trying to say, I mean, it comes back to the thing you're talking about plausibility versus probability.
Yeah.
It seems very hard to know enough about times and environments then to make quantitative estimates that would allow one to assign probability to different paths. Like I said, right. I'd love to be proved wrong. I'm sort of
principally
skeptical.
Fair. Okay, so there's potentially two things to try to do, and I don't know how we're doing it for time. One way I think that might be useful, so one thing would be really interesting, we can either do it now or later, would be to sit down and actually try to do some kind of calculation, because I agree, we don't know what the plausible variable is, but if what we could do is say, well, this is how you might do this kind of calculation, right? Mixed population, two things that are competing, right? So then you've got their, you know, equal one-to-one growth rate or genome size or whatever. And then if all of a sudden that dynamic changes to where one is no longer competing for resources, it is simply now a predator on the other one. But they're at very, very low number, right? It's a rare mutation that does that, because that's my thought about the origin, at least, of the phagocytic system, right? If all of a sudden you gain the capacity to not have to biosynthetically compete for resources with the first guy, and you can just eat them instead, then how big of a population? If one guy does it, well, then that's not going to help. But if it's 2, 3, or if they have a rapid growth rate, or if it, I mean, that sort of thing, we could potentially put some ranges on the model. The other potential thing to do, and where I think this might be useful, is if we can have more defined models where people have put out the hypotheses, can we say we can turn that now into equations? Say, well, they are postulating the following, and therefore we need to know what kinds of ranges are necessary. And if you can say, well, you would require a population, you know, in order to make that model work for more than one or two generations, you need to have an effective population size of 10 to the 20th. You go, well, even the biggest population, effective population size is on like 10 to the 11th. You can rule that model out. Or you can say that's only going to work if your effective population size goes through a bottleneck of one organism per, tremendously small bottlenecks. It's possible, but hard. I don't know if this is a useful thing to do or not. So, Paul, Boris, Nicole.
So, I think you're trying to get us to think in terms of populations instead of an individual cell. You're trying to say things didn't just happen in one cell. But I'd like you to make that case as to why the population is wrong. Because it seems to me that things have to happen in one cell. Okay, a cell is a member of a population,
right.
But a thing has to happen in one cell. And it has to be a heritable thing at the end of the day.
No, I think I would make the argument that, or my argument is, which I'm happy to say is wrong, is that the default in the literature is people tend to think of these things as if it happens in one cell, and I am asking the question whether thinking about them in a population context adds some sort of utility to the discussion. And I don't know enough about how this works.
Why one cell is important? Because the kind of things that you're interested in would be like where one thing becomes dependent on another. So, for example, transfer of a gene from a mitochondria to a
nucleus. Sure.
Or if you have two things working together and one of them loses a gene, now it's dependent on the other one because only the other one has that gene.
Yeah.
So those things happen once, don't they? And then they get passed on. So okay, this thing, this change happens in one cell. It's a member of a population, but it has to then go to fixation. So why does the population matter?
Okay, so I think there's two ways in which the population might help, and I might just be wrong. One is if, in the case where you guys were saying that Mike is saying, you know, eukaryotes and alpha proteobacteria, this isn't an accident. This happens all the time, and that you can start dealing with some of these issues of either sort of gene trading, whatever. In a case where you have fusion of cytoplasm, right, so syngamy, right, you have a real sexual process, then as soon as it happens in one, anything that that is now fusing with, it can then be happening in more than one. And I think the other would be that very quickly, you would have, I mean, it might have happened just once, but then that cell is going to divide. So long as it doesn't lose it, now two cells, you know, one cell becomes two, and very, very quickly in a very small set of generations, you become, with one event, but very, very quickly over evolutionary time, it becomes a population. Is that a reasonable?
Yeah, so if it becomes, if it spreads through the population quickly, then the population is not very relevant anymore. I mean, it's basically the event, the question is, what was the event and why was that event selected, right? That is not too relevant, the fact that there was
Then there's also these questions where we don't know if selection, you know, the relative power of selection versus neutral processes, which again, I don't think people are really taking into account in these types of discussions.
But don't you think it's for want of knowledge? Like, presumably that would need some knowledge of the environment.
I think it's for want. I would argue, and again, I'm going to get some angry emails and letters as soon as this goes online. I'm guessing it is for want of familiarity with this field. That people are just not—they're not thinking about it because they don't know to think about it. Carpenters use hammers and saws and nails, and not some other tool because that's what they're good at. I don't know. I mean, maybe I'm completely wrong.
There is definitely, personally, lack of familiarity. But when we're talking about events reaching a billion years into the past, I think we lack the necessary knowledge about the environment, the population sizes, you talk about genetic architecture. I think, I wanted to respond to your question about our desire to define sharp questions. I think we all have that desire, and I frankly don't think it's possible right now. I think we do need to kind of cast it out and bounce ideas off each other. I don't think we know how to define the right questions.
I guess if people are currently, so maybe it's also in comparison to how people are currently framing the questions. We are currently framing the questions in exactly these terms of plausibility versus probability, but no one, maybe I'm wrong, is using numbers to do that. We're just kind of going, well, that feels like it should be more probable, as opposed to, can we put any kind of rigor to this and say, yeah, this is, here we can calculate some probabilities of something, versus...
The human genetic story right now is an incredible, the establishment of techniques for sequencing ancient DNA has completely changed the discussion. And now there's a data set that changes everything. Hmm? And I think that's where we are. Like, we don't have access to the type of data that we need. And it's not, I don't think it's going to be DNA in the case of, I don't think it's going to be ancient DNA, but I think that there's a black box to it, and we don't yet know what's going to fix it.
Right. Yes, I agree. And what this discussion was supposed to be about was, is there any way in which population genetics can help us get inside that black box? And if the answer turns out to be no, then that's fine.
Sort of way of looking at it. The problem is, I think if you said we know this change required one mutation, then I think we could set out your probabilities given any and given some knowledge of mutation rate. And if it was two, we probably could say something from how it scales with these things. And three, it would be harder, we could probably do it. But beyond that, it gets very hard. But the kind of traits you're talking about, like the origin of the spliceosome or Bagger trophy,
Yeah.
We have no idea how many steps were involved, and I don't see that.
Right. Well, and this is sort of what...
It's nice to hear population genetics getting some acknowledgement, but there are limits, too.
And maybe I'm even using the term population. I will grab you in just a sec, and I apologize. Maybe I'm actually using the term wrong. Maybe I'm not asking for population genetics. Maybe I'm just asking for some sort of mathematical modeling of these processes to try to put some numerical rigor behind what people are currently, I think we're currently using intuitive senses of probability versus plausibility and that there might be a way to do that in a more rigorous way. And so it doesn't necessarily have to be a population genetics thing, but some sort of modeling
one area
to that.
It could be very helpful. I guess Boris needs
and,
to.
Yeah, and Boris.
Evolution of replication fidelity, right? I mean, I think we can make some statements about that. I mean, to do any of this stuff, you've got to have a pretty decent sized genome, right? And, you know, that requires that you have a pretty low error rate replicating your genome. Statements can be made along those lines, at least crudely, in order of magnitude.
Yeah.
I mean, Eigen sort of talked about that.
Yeah. Well, we're, sorry, Boris, go ahead.
Well, I guess there's a few things that, first thing I'll pick up Mike's strand there on fidelity, right? So there are people like Shostak's lab trying to evolve cell replicating enzymes. And that's one of those well-defined exercises. One can really try to think about, they have, right, it's chemistry. There is some sort of phase space of possibilities, which is vaguely denumerable, albeit very, very large. And one can sort of start asking, how many configurations are there in this problem? Right, there could be more than one solution to this problem. Yeah. And along the just developing this a little bit into this question of plausibility, probability. So right now we're talking about one path, right? So you have this tree and you're trying to ask what's the probability of this happening? And you're saying, well, right, it started in one cell, but then of course it has to rapidly spread in the population, and you're absolutely right. This is what happens.
Yeah.
But let's think about this a little bit differently. So it happened in one cell, right? But there are many things that happened in different cells. Most of them died.
Yeah.
Right? We're looking at the outcome of these 3 billion years, and you can ask, well, you know, what's the probability of what happened? Well, you know, Eugene Koonin gave a talk here a few years ago trying to put a number on the probability of this happening, and he ended up talking about alternative universes, right? He basically said, well, you know, we live in a universe where it happened, but there is an uncountable number which we need in order to make this happen. So, let me put another twist on this thing. Ask the question, well, what's the probability of nothing happening, right? we're looking at the outcome of something, right?
Yeah. Well, or rather, the reason that we're asking the question is because we're in the path that it actually happened.
Right. So, right? So these are somewhat always imponderable. Yeah. But what I'm trying to now I'll try to turn this philosophy into some sort of a question that perhaps can be confined and molded into an answerable tidbit. So how many ways are there to do the same thing? How many ways are there to achieve the same phenotype? So how many different bacteria, if you like, could have the archaean swallowed and improved its survival in the presence of oxygen or something?
Right.
So, but that's a hard problem.
Well, no, I'm not sure that it is a hard problem.
The question of this multiplicity of phenotypes is something I think one can...
So I'm not sure that it is a hard problem, and I think this is where a lot of the plausibility arguments come from, is you say, well, we look around today, and we see that actually endosymbiotic bacteria or bacterial associations between mixed populations, they happen all the time. So it is, in fact, highly plausible that you would get an ecological thing that might give rise to this kind of thing. Or you go, well, we've never seen that before, so yeah, you can propose that, but you know, now you're just wishing for unicorns, right? And I think that so you can get at that by looking at modern things. Are there other examples where this has happened? So that's actually, to me, that's actually a fairly simple one, and that is basically just going out and looking at diversity and looking at bacterial communities and so on.
So effectively, the argument would be the bacteria invaded the archaea. I mean, like, it's
that's one argument.
Output,
well, okay, all right. So let me explore one thing that you said, and then if we have time, let me just talk about two of the different types of theories, and they're not the only theories, but they're the, sort of the ones from the O'Malley paper that are the most representative. So you were saying about it happened in one cell, and then many, many, many lineages died, right? To me, there's a way of modeling that, right? I don't know how to do it, but I'm assuming that there's a way of modeling that, right? And then you draw a path through something that now exists. That is, to me, I think, a different type of math than a trait arose in this lineage, and a trait arose over here, and it arose over here, and it arose over here, and in a population that is changing and exchanging genes, you get combinations that now work better, and so you don't have to come up with a single origin of an individual trait. You can stack them, you can put them together, and to me, those are two very different things. And maybe I'm wrong, but I think the math behind those are different. And that if you go, well, this one is incredibly unlikely to get us where we are, and this one could maybe do it, that helps. Maybe that's something you should be thinking about incorporating into the theories going forward. And that's what I was sort of hoping we might, that, I mean, if you guys are telling me that this is just not a useful approach, then that's fine, and other people can just go on doing what they're doing. So the two types of flavors of model, right? One is a cell, an archaean, presumably, or some form of cell gradually took on many eukaryotic traits and then later took on a mitochondrion. And so the most sort of prominent version of this theory are the sorts of things that Tom Cavalier-Smith talks about. This is his 2002 one. He's updated it much more recently than that. But basically, you know, first you lose a bacterial cell wall, then you come up with some solution to that problem. And so the eukaryote solution was cytoskeleton. So that means then cytoskeleton is next, right? And then you come up with a way to do phagocytosis, and then that's next. And it gives some sort of predictable orders of these traits, right? And it's based on probability and we've talked about this, he and I, a couple of times, if you do go through a bottleneck, if you have something that has to happen, you either die, and you'll die many, many times, or you survive for some reason, and then you move to the next step, right? And that is, again, those have different mathematical formulations, right? So that's one flavor of model, and then we were talking about that, you know, is it gradual versus catastrophic? How do you talk about that in a mathematical language, right? So then there's the syntrophic theories, right? So you've got mutual independence or interdependence between two groups, and this explains the genomic chimerism very, very well, and it also works very nicely with the existence of biofilms, mixed biofilms, right? We see these in nature, right? And then eventually there's just a fusion. The interdependence becomes so high that that happens, and that would be sort of this version of the hydrogen hypothesis, which really is Bill Martin. The initial version in 1998 was Miklos Müller and Bill Martin, and then a more recent version is, I think, Martin and Kunin talking about the origin of the nucleus. And again, this is, I think, the best worked out example of this.
Why are they different?
Why are they different? One is a single lineage that gains a bunch of traits and then and becomes essentially something we would recognize as a eukaryote. And then later on, it picks up essentially a bacterium, right? So a mitochondria. This one is through a single stochastic integration event. You get a chimeric fusion, and then that produces, so it doesn't have to produce the mitochondria, but the best worked out theory is the one that does, that is an alpha proteobacteria and some archaean of some kind.
So the difference is when the mitochondria comes relative.
Well, that's one of them. No, I think that's one of them. I think the other point is that one is a stochastic event that then explains many traits versus the different traits being taken on differentially and sequentially over a long period of time. One tends to favor probability of events, one tends to favor plausibility, and then this idea of stochasticity. And then I'll just get to this last one, which I'm putting up almost because of the title, which is a new fusion hypothesis for the origin of eukaryotes, better than previous ones, but probably also wrong, which is, I think, my current favorite title of a paper ever. And one of the reasons I like it, A, it's funny, but it's also really scholarly because he really does spend quite a bit of time at the end of the paper talking about the shortfalls of his own theory. What does this theory not cover? Where are the open questions? And what is a new, better theory going to have to do? So it's actually a beautiful paper. And in this case, we didn't know about Loki. He is proposing planktomycete. So it's bacteria plus archaea that then produces the phagotrophic eukaryote that then later on takes on the alpha proteobacteria. So it's kind of a hybrid hypothesis of both. Like I said, I'm not going to pick a contributor, but I like this idea that there might have been some other contributor that explains the bacterial genes beyond simply the mitochondria. That would actually be explanatory in a number of different ways.
Yeah. I have to read this MLA paper. It sounds interesting, but what I think is interesting to me is that these different models for the origin of eukaryotes reflect improvements in our understanding of organisms alive today. So the phagotrophic model from Cavalier-Smith predates the appreciation that these thought to be amitochondria eukaryotes in fact have mitochondria, and so the notion that there had to, that mitochondria came late.
It stems from, so I think it stemmed from that, but it's not requisite. So the archaezoan idea is not inherently requisite from that. Now, obviously, it intellectually came from there, but you don't have, because this is not the last common ancestor. This is just conceptually something might have arisen that took on eukaryotic traits and then later took on a mitochondria.
But that had to have been the case until we appreciated that mitochondria were.
Yes.
So that had to be right.
Exactly.
And now it doesn't have to be right.
Yes.
And then the syntrophy one, we wouldn't have thought to propose that until you have genome sequences showing that.
Yeah.
That, and so I think it's kind of this brave, it's a frontier right now. We're still learning more about what's out there. And then the hydrogen hypothesis, again, is out of really cool recent results showing archaea and bacteria living in tight association being interdependent.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I don't think we know.
and I think there's still, even further things. This theory, the appreciation of the thalmarchaea was just really coming about when this theory was proposed, right? One of the things that is in that paper that I think is a little bit different, I would probably say that I favor some form of a fusion, potentially fusion that then picks up a mitochondria afterwards, so more of a syntrophy type of thing, and yet I'm spending a lot of time thinking about the cell biology, right? So that sort of epistemological or sort of intellectual history breaks down, right? And I think a lot of people are now doing that. They're realizing they have to think about all of these things and not prioritize one versus the other. So Shelley.
So I'm just going to maybe summarize this or get us to point. So this idea that we should be able to say, like, these things need to get done to figure this out. So am I right that what you're saying is we're way early in this process, and that we should appreciate the fact that people are proposing different kinds of models, because the models are going to be the thing that points in the direction of what experiments we can do, what experiments we would like to do, but we can't do now, and that this is just a process. Is that sort of what you're saying?
I think we're very early, and I also think there are data out there that are going to crack this open, and we don't know what they are, and we don't even know what experiments.
I would go back to Andrew's point where not necessarily any theory that then makes a testable prediction is a much more valuable theory, because at least it pushes You know, if you can provide the experiment that then falsifies yourself, you've done a service to everybody. Right? And that was one of the beautiful things about the Archezoa hypothesis, right? Was it was really dominant, and the data that then disproved it was really came about from Tom's grad student, who was Andrew Roger, right? And Tom said, great, go out, you know, yeah, that's a great way of testing my theory. Please go out. And it turns out he was completely wrong. And he was really good about that. So I think, again, credit goes to him and the field in finding testable ways of doing that. So if anybody's interested in coming up with a new theory, I would argue that don't send it to an editor until there's maybe some sort of possible prediction that you can think of that might come from that. I don't know.
Okay, anyway. But I think the goal is to try to disprove your hypothesis.
Right, exactly. Well, particularly something that will falsify your theory.
And sometimes that can't be done. I don't know that that's always going to be possible until, because of the time scale and also because there's a lot of eukaryotic diversity that we have to sample.
True.
And so I think I applaud the goal. I'm very excited about this question and these macroevolutionary questions, and I think it's a really hard one to try to be quantitative about plausibility versus probability, because I think there's just so much.
So I'll talk whenever I'm talking. I'll talk about some of the work that we're doing to try to address some of these questions by working backwards using standard phylogenetic methods in a robust way, where we can test some of these things. That's working backwards from the last common ancestor and the proximal steps, because that's where I'm comfortable. Like, this is all just it's all theory and hypothesis. And I don't know how to do it distractibly. This other question we do, and we can start walking our way backwards. And as the methods get better, we can ask better and better questions and so on. So I agree with you, same sort of thing. So maybe it's time for caffeine?
Yeah, maybe.
Okay, thanks.